Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, our look ahead at the coming 2 weeks in the global business landscape, brought to you by Control Risks, the international risk consultancy. I'm Global Research Director Charles Hecker, based here in London.
And in New York, I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis. Welcome to the podcast.
In this edition, we examine the pressing issue of aviation security and global terrorism. We'll also look at the evolving partnership between the United States and India as investment-friendly Prime Minister Narendra Modi prepares his state visit to Washington.
But first, let's check in on crisis-ridden Venezuela, where President Nicolas Maduro continues to extend powers amid deepening economic distress. Joining me from our Bogota office is Raul Gallegos, Control Risk's chief Venezuela analyst and author of the upcoming book Crude Nation, How Oil Riches Ruined Venezuela.
So, Raul, the state of emergency was recently extended. This, I don't think, came as a great surprise to people, but it does suggest that Nicolas Maduro is having no luck in stabilizing the situation. Can you give us a sense of where this is going over the next couple of months?
Yes, absolutely. I think the president has had no luck in stabilizing the situation because he is clearly not taking the steps needed for that to happen. Maduro right now is tied up because he cannot undo capital and price controls outright. That would make the situation in the short term much worse. And certainly with his popularity at critically low levels, he is also trying to delay a referendum on his rule, which the opposition is trying to pursue. So what we expect to see over the next few months is increasing levels of protests and social upheaval in the streets as we expect Chavismo to delay the referendum until after mid-January 2017. It is at that date when, should the referendum go through and should Maduro be ousted through that mechanism, the vice president would take over and finish the remaining 2 years of his term. So it is until that date that it is safe for Chavismo to allow a referendum to go through.
So from the outside looking in, what are overseas businesses to think of the environment in Venezuela right now? And if they're plotting ahead, at what point do you think it will offer some opportunity?
I think for the next year or two, opportunity will be hard to come by. I think the opportunity in Venezuela will be for those that are already operating in Venezuela, that have a decent chunk of their own markets, and that have the deep pockets necessary to stick around, even in the absence of foreign exchange to import raw materials, lack of raw materials, trouble with unions, and a government that is willing to seize assets at any minute to justify and to blame the ongoing political and economic crisis on companies. So it is certainly not obviously a time for new players to come in, but it is a time when we will see a number of weaker companies or companies that don't have the deep pockets to stick around and those that have smaller percentages of their markets. But we will continue to see very large multinational companies that have been in Venezuela for many years, trying to stick around so they can be the last ones standing, if you will, when and if eventually a new government takes over from Chavismo.
Well, Raul Gallegos in Bogota, thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mike, thanks. While we search for explanations behind the loss of Egypt Air Flight 804, we're confronted with a difficult situation. We have no technical data to talk about a mechanical error, nor do we have an admission from a terrorist organization that the flight was intentionally brought down out of the sky. Joining me today in London is Jonathan Wood, our transnational terrorism and aviation security expert. Jonathan, what should we be thinking about as we evaluate some of the reasons that may have brought down this aircraft?
Well, you're exactly right, and it's important to point out that there is simply not enough information at this point to draw a firm conclusion about what resulted in the crash or what caused the crash of Egypt Air Flight 804. Until further information from flight data recorders or other instruments is obtained, it's going to be speculation. But within the environment in which this crash occurred, and certainly what has driven a lot of the coverage of it, it does appear to be the case that aircraft and aviation more generally are facing an elevated or escalated threat environment from terrorist and militant groups. We had last October, for the first time in more than 10 years, a terrorist group incidentally based in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula claim responsibility for an aircraft bombing that resulted in the destruction of that aircraft. We had subsequent to that a series of unprecedented attempted bombings in Somalia of aircraft. And beyond that, we had the bomb attack against the airport in Brussels, all of which indicate that for the first time in a number of years, terrorists and militant groups are deliberately and concertedly targeting aviation assets. Bear in mind, the last really significant attempted attack was in 2010 when the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen disguised some bombs as printer cartridges and tried to bomb cargo flights to the U.S. We are now seeing a resurgence of this type of targeting of aviation in particular.
Jonathan, what are some of the factors that go into this new threat environment? What are its ingredients, if you will?
Well, the threat environment for aviation has changed both because of this apparent increase in the intent of these militant groups, but also because of the conflicts that are continuing in places like Syria, Iraq, and parts of North Africa, such as Libya. We have, out of these conflicts, both permissive environments for militant groups to operate within, and we also have a proliferation of small arms, some of which are specific anti-aviation weapons, such as what are so-called MANPADs, or man-portable air defense systems, basically shoulder-launched surface-to-air missiles. There's a great deal of concern about the proliferation of these weapons combined with the expansion of groups that are willing and trying to use them against civil aircraft in a number of jurisdictions. There have been cases of these weapons being recently used mainly against military aircraft, but they certainly also pose a threat to civil aircrafts, particularly those at low altitude and also in close proximity to airports. So the main threat variables seem to be the operational extent of militant groups, their access to certain types of weapons, and then within some threat environments, think your Afghanistan, Pakistan, parts of the Middle East as well, their intent to target ground aviation assets, so airports and potentially military bases that are also co-located with civilian airports, all of which have led to attacks on those types of assets.
Jonathan, finally, what is it that commercial operators, what is it that airlines are doing to deal with this new threat environment?
Well, the kind of appreciation or understanding of the threat environment has changed very dramatically, actually, since the flight was shot down over eastern Ukraine in 2014. This really focused the mind of both civil air operators as well as the public sector, so government agencies, civil aviation authorities, on these underlying threat variables, which include, of course, conflict situations and the presence of militant groups. And also military aircraft activity, for example, the increasing frequency of surveillance flights in places like the South China Sea, the Baltic Sea, and other parts of the Middle East. We now see operators looking much more closely and trying to assess these risks, really to get a grip on where these conflicts are going, what are sources of potential future conflict in the environment, so do we see tensions rising between countries? And we've also seen more efforts by the public sector and between public and private sector organizations to share information and to ensure that the understanding of the threat environment is as consistent and as widely transmitted as possible so that you try to avoid situations where some operators may not know about underlying threats.
Jonathan Wood, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, the United States and India often get lumped together as the world's largest democracies. During the Cold War, however, that seemed to do little to warm their relationship. Recent years have seen the two cozy up, and this week India's Modi will be in Washington to meet with President Barack Obama. Joining me is James Owen, Senior Managing Director in our Delhi office and Head of India Operations for Control Risks. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Mike.
So, James, you've been with us in the United States for a week, taking the pulse of various clients around the country. The president of India now is in D.C. in the coming week. What is Mr. Modi looking for from the United States?
Well, Mike, yeah, I think he is looking to deepen the relationship that actually he has had quite a lot of success in developing over the last 2 years. This is actually Modi's fourth visit in the 2 short years that he's been in office in India. And indeed, this taken with Obama's visit to India as the chief guest at the India Republic Day celebrations in January 2015 is a good indicator of the fact that actually the relationship now is stronger than it ever has been between the two countries. Broadly, India and the US have always seen themselves as natural and strategic allies, rooted in common concerns about instability and growing Islamist extremism in Pakistan, as well as, of course, the regional ambitions of China. But India, I think, right now is keen to take advantage of U.S. expertise and technology to help boost its domestic agenda in India. So I'm thinking in particular about the defense sector, but is also keen, I would say, to avoid being too closely identified with or strategically beholden to the U.S. as well.
Now, there was a moment earlier this year where there was talk of India joining a maritime patrol in the South China Sea with Japan and the United States and others. That the Indians very quickly knocked that down. Just how sensitive is that topic with regard to India?
Well, it is sensitive because it cuts to the core of how India is considering the way in which it should engage in the world right now as a power that has traditionally had a very non-aligned focus in its foreign policy. It is right now weighing up the competing options of both furthering and developing its relationship with Washington. And indeed, it has made its own calls for freedom of navigation, especially in the South China Sea, where China's assertion of its territorial claims has unnerved, obviously, its neighbors in the region. But at the same time, the prime minister, and he's made comments on this only in the last few days, has been very keen to play down any friction with China, pointing to increasing trade and diplomatic exchanges between the two nations. So it's a tight line that the prime minister is trying to walk between ensuring that he is developing the relationship with both countries. But overall, the U.S. certainly has been a priority for India in the last couple of years.
So if you're doing business in India now as an American company, does this change anything? India's federal system is notoriously difficult to navigate. The bureaucracy is legend, to say it nicely. Should an American company looking to do business in India feel better because the relationship at the top is better?
Well, I think at a broad level, the strategic and geopolitical relationship between Delhi and Washington has been stronger than the trade and investment relationship. But I think that is starting to change. And actually, it's starting to change because the reform agenda that Modi embarked upon 2 years ago is now starting to bear fruit in a way that perhaps some thought that it might not, given the challenges the government has run into in actually implementing some of the key reforms that it sought to achieve around land, labor, and tax in the country. But if you look at, for example, some of the more recent announcements around the national bankruptcy law, the release of a national intellectual property rights policy in the last few weeks, and several steps taken over the last years on ease of doing business, such as streamlining bureaucratic decision-making, opening up investment in key sectors like railway, defense, and e-commerce, taking steps towards growing the civil nuclear market by making it more open to U.S. companies such as Westinghouse. I think what you're seeing there is India opening itself up to American business in a way that it hasn't done before, and you're starting to see an increase in FDI inflows from the U.S. into India as a result.
James Owen, speaking to us today from Minneapolis in the Midwest of the United States. Safe travels back to Delhi.
Thanks, Mike.
Mike, before we wrap up, let's touch on a few more events on the risk radar over the next 2 weeks. Saturday, 4 June, marks the anniversary of the 1989 government crackdown on pro-democracy student protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Travelers to the Chinese capital can expect an increased security presence and local traffic restrictions as activists plan to commemorate the event.
On Friday, 10 June, the 2016 UEFA European Championship will begin in France. The country will welcome up to 8 million supporters across 10 cities over the course of the month-long tournament. The French Interior Minister has promised a very high security level amid continuing concerns about terrorism.
Mike, thanks. That wraps up this edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. Our podcast is produced every other Friday and can be found on iTunes, Podbean, or the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. There you can download our latest report, The Peace Dividend, Risks and Rewards for the Private Sector in Colombia's Post-Conflict Period.
For now, this is Michael Moran in New York, signing off.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker. Thanks very much for listening.